Hi, this is Jesse from Last Stop This Song, and you're listening to CJLO 1690 AM in Montreal.
For CJLO News, I'm Danny O'Bree. Bell Canada plans to start construction this spring within the province of Saskatchewan to build what they intend to be Canada's largest AI data center. CEO of Bell Canada, Mirko Bibic, stated that the company will be partnering with the Saskatchewan government as they spend $1.7 billion on the project. He also stated that the project will add 800 temporary construction jobs and 80 full-time jobs when the facility starts operating in 2027. Since the data center became public knowledge back in February, it has been receiving public criticism about the project's energy consumption and water usage. The City of Montreal is canceling plans to remove trash cans from Parc Lafontaine over the summer. The plan proposed replacing 80 garbage cans around the park's interior with large collection bins around the exits to the park. The union representatives for the workers responsible for park maintenance said that they were concerned that the change would increase littering. A similar project was attempted along the Lachine Canal in 2024 before it was canceled because visitors complained about the disappearance of garbage cans. American actor Matt Clark passed away late last week at his home in Austin, Texas due to complications from back surgery. Born in Washington, D.C. in 1936, Clark first got into acting in the late 1950s when he joined New York's Living Theater Company and starred in Broadway plays. He later appeared in several Western films, such as The Life and Times of Judge Roy Bean, The Cowboys, and the Clint Eastwood film The Outlaw Josie Wales, but was best known for portraying Chester the Bartender in Back to the Future Part 3. He also appeared in popular TV shows such as Kung Fu, Magnum P.I., Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman, and portrayed Emmett Kelly in Grace Under Fire. Matt Clark is survived by his wife Sharon and 5 children. He was 89 years old. For more information, go to cjlo.com/news.
That's how it starts.
Hello, hello. Welcome to our show, Towards a Common Horizon. You're listening to CJLO 1690 AM. I am Hope, and I'm joined by Haley, if you want to just say a quick hi.
Hello.
Hello. If you've listened to us before, we are the Montreal chapter of the national group Common Horizon, where we are building a mass movement of everyday people. We come together to take power away from the billionaire class and win solutions to the climate crisis to secure good jobs, address affordability, and ensure a dignified life for all. We have chapters across the country, but we're the first ones with a radio show, which is super exciting. And so if you've tuned in before, every 2 weeks we'll be here on Sundays at 8 p.m. We chat about things like climate and affordability and many other things along that realm, connecting dots between systems of inequality, climate collapse, and, you know, generally just trying to shine light on solutions that can address all of these different crises that we're facing today. And so, yeah, this week we are going to talk about the cost of war and Canada's role within it, current and previous energy crises, and the opportunity to transition to a fossil-free world. Many, many current topics that I'm sure are on many people's minds right now. Before we get started, we're just going to have a little bit of an ad break, and then we're going to get right back to it afterwards. So stay tuned.
Hi, this is Chaz from Toro et Moi, and I'd rather be listening to CJLO 1690 AM in Montreal. Hi, this is Chaz from Toro et Moi, and I'd rather be listening to CJLO 1690 AM in Montreal. Hi, this is...
If you're interested in audio storytelling at all, volunteer with CJLO's news department. We'll teach you the ins and outs of audio journalism, no experience needed. You'll learn interviewing, scripting, recording, editing, and we'll support you every step of the way on your journey to producing your own original reporting. We also take a lot of pride in our local focus and coverage of the issues often forgotten by mainstream outlets. Join the team and get your voice on air by filling out a volunteer application form at cjlo.com/volunteer. Or come to one of our weekly pitch meetings, Mondays at 1 p.m. on the Loyola campus, CC430.
The Go-Go Radio Magic Show. Every Friday night from 6 to 8 on CJLO.
This one goes out to the one I love.
Okay, we're back. So you're listening to our show, Towards a Common Horizon. We are excited to talk about, well, maybe not excited is the right word, but we're going to get into a lot of chatting about some heavy topics today, but hopefully, you know, still infusing a little bit of hope as well. So yeah, we're going to investigate and explore what many people are thinking about probably right now, which is the current war in the Middle East right now, and Canada's complicity in it, and eventually maybe what we can hope for it, or if there's any kind of opportunities from that. So yeah, we're just going to talk a little bit to begin with about the cost of war. And so obviously war takes a very human toll. Many lives are being affected, both in the region, but by many people who are affected in the diaspora as well. Many people have families that they are really worried about or they can't get in touch with. This is also really like important spiritual time that is really being disrupted by this war as well. So, you know, obviously there's a massive human toll and human cost. That is indescribable and something that we are not even going to attempt to try to address in full today. As a more climate focused show, we're going to talk about more the carbon costs and the financial kind of financialization by our country Canada today, and focus a little bit more on that instead. And so, yeah, I mean, obviously, when we think about war, the obvious first thing that comes to mind is how destructive it is, obviously, to populations and our infrastructure. But thinking about what that looks like in terms of our carbon budget overall is kind of sobering. And so there was a headline just today in The Guardian where they found that there's been 5 million tons of CO2 emitted in just the last 14 days of the U.S. war on Iran, which is basically draining the global carbon budget faster than 84 countries combined. So, you know, already we know that the carbon cost of war is really extreme, and you know, this is because, you know, if we get scientific about it, it's because there's all this explosion, there's all this extra carbon emitted in the atmosphere from all of this combustion. Not only is there a lot of carbon, but, you know, different weapons have different, combustion byproducts. If you want to be like scientific about it, there's a lot of different chemicals that are being released. And these are noxious not only to the global atmosphere, but also to the general ecological climate. And so there's many different, studies, and not even, you know, you don't need a study to know that this is destructive. There's, you know, ecological systems that have been completely destroyed. Humans are really affected for generations to come by the different like noxious gases that are in the air, the different noxious chemicals that are going into the soils that are just ruining agricultural systems, that are ruining like habitats that will obviously have, you know, cascading effects when you think about, you know, we don't even know the toll on biodiversity. And we know that, you know, those all have, you know, accumulated effects too on regions. And so, you know, it's all pretty dire, whether or not you're looking at it from like a biodiversity lens, just like a larger carbon lens, a just general, you know, noxious chemical lens, environmentally, the act of war is obviously no surprise there, pretty insane. But then obviously there's also like more local costs too. You can kind of look at it in any kind of way, and we'll talk about that in a little bit too, in terms of even like the local environmental costs of producing weapons, whether or not it's here or elsewhere in the world. But yeah, we'll get a little bit more into that later. But yeah, I mean, do you want to add anything?
Yeah, I think also about like all of the things that are being bombed and like how much like the human toll of having to rebuild that, as well as the carbon toll. I recently, and I should not have done this at 1 a.m. because it really messed me up, but I was looking at Gaza, the Gaza Strip, on Google Maps, and it was just like so haunting that you could see from the air like how much the buildings had been completely blown to bits, decimated. And it was this haunting thing of like being able to see that, but then still remaining. There was like reviews for like a kebab shop and like a place that people would go and like an amusement park and all these things that are just like now completely gone, and like the people who love them are gone. And like it was horrible looking at these reviews and being like, are these people gone? So yeah, so both like from a human aspect and then also from climate, like the cost of rebuilding all of these things is massive. And it is just like gutting that like so much is being spent, so much carbon is being expanded or released into the atmosphere for just like sheer destruction. And yeah, it feels horrible. And yeah, let's talk a little bit about the way that Canada is complicit in that. So I have a clip, actually. I a couple weeks ago, attended the Broadband Institute in Ottawa, Annual Progress Summit, and there I was really fortunate to get to hear Rachel Smalls speak. She is an anti-war organizer, and she is a member of, I think, both the anti-arms embargo and also works for World Beyond War. So I'm going to play a quick clip of her speaking about some of the ways that Canada's military-industrial complex and manufacturing is complicit in the bombing of Palestine and the bombing of Iran. And then we're going to get to talk more about that and the ways that Carney is unfortunately just expanding this. So, clearing it up now.
Venezuela, notably censors made in Hamilton, Ontario, were key to the targeting of the strikes on Venezuelan boats. And of course, we've also known for the past 2 years just how critical a part of arming Israel's genocide the Canadian war machine has been. But if you look at the primary bombs that Israel's used, if you look at their 155-meter shells, if you look at the 2,000-pound bombs, the F-35s have been dropping nonstop on Gaza over the past 2 years, decimating cities of tents. Every single one of those F-35s, those fighter jets, those millions of dollars in Canadian parts, but also those 2,000-pound bombs that they are dropping, the explosives, the propellants in them, many of them are made in General Dynamics plants in Quebec. They go to the biggest bomb factories in the United States, and then they go to Israel. The TNT in them, all of it arrives from Poland to the port of Saguenay in Quebec, then travels on Canadian highways and railways down to the U.S. before ending up in these bombs. So all that to say that Canada is already deeply implicated in just like literally arming the worst, some of the worst violence on the planet. That's where Canadian arms are intentionally flowing, not to mention the ones that sometimes get diverted, that end up literally in the hands of Russian troops, that has been exposed recently, that end up being used in Sudan, that end up being used in all kinds of other places.
Yeah, Hope, any thoughts from that clip?
Yeah, so I think this is this kind of leads into a great perspective to remember that war, being in Canada doesn't excuse us from having bloody hands. We are certainly just as complicit in this war as those on the ground, like because of what Rachel was talking about, of the General Dynamics weapons factory here in Quebec, in this province directly. I think she obviously laid out really well the kind of impacts and the sheer scale of weapons that are being sent. And I think if anyone doesn't know already about the Loopholes Act. So a kind of brief primer is that basically Canada has like claimed that we are no longer sending arms to like Israel to send to use upon the Gazan people. There's a loophole act essentially which allows us to still be able to send and sell military products to the US, and we know that those are then used to send directly to Israel. And so like basically, you know, we can say like that's just a lie then. Like obviously we are completely complicit. There's no arms embargo at all. We are completely you know, our hands are still very bloody. And so this General Dynamics factory is just outside of Montreal. It's very close. And there was actually a proposal to expand it recently. And so there's been some really great organizing in terms of different groups who are trying to, you know, make the case to the government processes involving like environmental assessments to curb and stop the expansion. And they point to things, so because it's an environmental assessment, they point to things that are very environmentally focused. So, you know, the destruction of wetlands if you expand, which have cascading effects on like flooding or biodiversity or things like that. But then there's also, of course, the contamination of water with heavy metals, air with heavy metals. A lot of local residents in the area have like higher rates of cancer. You know, like we know there's like human tolls as well with even just these like local manufacturings of these really like evil weapons. And so, yeah, obviously there's some great environmental arguments for these local weapons manufacturing, but then also even just making that connection between, you know, I think Canada loves to pretend like we, you know, we're pacifists, we're not involved, and whereas like this is happening in our own backyard.
Yeah, I've been so frustrated by the way that the Carney government is just like really speaking out of both sides of its mouth on this, or I guess sort of saying one thing and then doing the other. Like there was that Davos speech that everyone freaked out about, where, you know, Carney went and was challenging, you know, like U.S. imperialism and hegemony, and being like, we need to turn away from this way of doing, the rules-based order has fallen apart, and, you know, making a lot of like elbows up stuff and being like, we're distancing ourselves from America. But if we're selling them arms, you know, I don't think we are actually dissing ourselves in any way. I think we're completely complicit in this. And, you know, Carney made a big show of being like, okay, we're not going to commit any troops to the war in Iran. But, you know, if we're selling weapons to the U.S., like, the U.S. is actively bombing Iran, like, we play a role in that. And I feel like it's just, like, so frustrating. And it's just, like, yeah, this, like, disgusting thing of being like, oh, we're going to say it's bad, but we're still going to profit off of it. And yeah, I think it's like most Canadians, it's like not what their vision or hope for this country would be. And yeah, I think, you know, this is like already going on, the weapons sales. And one thing to note is that, the Carney government has been directly challenged on this loophole that is allowing arms to be sent to Israel from Canada. And there was like a recent vote, there was a private members bill trying to close the loophole that happened, I think, like a week or a little bit ago, and unfortunately, like, it totally failed. You know, this could have been like a really strong statement and saying like, okay, this is an obvious genocide, like we're not, no longer going to be sending weapons, but instead, you know, it was voted down. And there was I would say a number of Liberal MPs that broke with the party line. This is, I think, in large part because there's been like really smart riding by riding organizing being done by, you know, folks from the Palestine Youth Movement, from the Arms Embargo Now organizing, trying to put pressure on their Liberal MPs. And so I think like a number of Liberal MPs broke, and that is promising to see some like ideological fractures in the party on this. But still just like disgusting that it is persistent.
No, yeah, it's always just so disappointing when, you know, there's so many people who are expressing outrage and using the democratic avenues for us that have been laid out for us to have a voice and kind of watch that not even matter. You know, it feels quite futile, I think, mm-hmm. Sometimes. And especially when, what does that leave the average person to do when we're just watching on our phones these like tragedies upon tragedies and, you know, wanting to do something other than just like sign a petition. And then even when that petition does go as far as like being able to be presented in the House and, you know, have the actual potential to do something and still watch it be, you know, shot down is like definitely, really discouraging and, disappointing. But also definitely not to, as you said, like a lot of MPs broke with their party and voted against it and or voted to pass the bill, the member party bill. And, you know, and that's not nothing, you know, that means that there is movement still. And like, I think, you know, I mean, as an organization, we think about this all the time in terms of like, what does it look like to face losses, but acknowledge the wins within those losses. And you know, keep moving forward because, you know, one loss doesn't mean it's over and we have to give up. You know, it means, okay, that one didn't win, but let's try another thing and let's try another thing. And, you know, it might look like a private member's bill at the federal level, but it also might look like a local disruption at the environmental assessment for your local weapons manufacturer in your backyard. You know, it looks like talking to your neighbors. Like, did you know that Quebec has the largest weapons manufacturer in Canada that is being I don't know if it's the largest one, but I think it is.
It's definitely a huge one.
Yeah. That like, did you know that like it's happening literally here in our backyard? Like maybe they didn't. And, and then maybe like that, you know, you start somewhere, you have to start somewhere.
Mm-hmm. I think maybe we can talk more then also about, so this is already happening, like Canada's arms dealing. But what is, it's a bit of a doom and gloom episode.
I know.
Sorry, everyone. but I think it's important to talk about it. So there's now like in the last federal budget that was released in the fall, we saw, Carney's promise to create, I had the number here, 81.8 billion dollars to be spent over the next 5 years on rearming the Canadian Armed Forces. And so that is just like a massive amount of money. And like, where is that money coming from? That is coming from massive cuts to the public sector, so many jobs lost, massive cuts to transit transfers to cities. What else, Hope? Am I forgetting something?
Those are definitely main cuts, but I mean, yeah, I mean, obviously we know that so many public workers are being cut and being consolidated. So many departments are being consolidated across the board. Where is that money going towards? Like probably funding this. And I mean, we were talking before this about how, you know, the arguments against like investing in other things is always like, well, where's the money coming from? Where's the money coming from? And for some reason, war is just this large exception. We're seeing this in countries across the world. Defense budgets are going up and like no one's like, oh, where's the money coming from? Everyone's like, well, we just have to do it and we'll find the money. And it's like, well, that's okay. What? Like now it doesn't matter where money is coming from. Like now when the costs are, if anything, higher than ever, now we don't care that we just have the money. Like it's very clear. It's made very clear priorities and,
I like in some like perverse way, like almost sort of see like there's like sort of like a silver lining to me is in almost like demonstrating like the way that like actually money can be massively mobilized and like the government is capable of like massive industrial policy, massive funding, and, you know, creating hundreds of thousands of jobs and like changing our industry and economy. So like obviously it's like being changed right now into like the most sick, twisted, evil thing I could imagine. And that is really hurting my heart. But I think it like does sort of like bolster our argument that like this same thing is possible for a just transition, for a green energy revolution, for a transition where we're, you know, investing more in making Canada like a green energy superpower, investing in our public education, investing in all the things that like actually matter and would make life better for us. The current thing is there's in February, the government just put out this like, and again, this is like the first thing ever. This is not a normal thing, but this defense industrial strategy. And so it's this massive injection. This current one is $6.6 billion cash injected into Canadian military industries. And so, what are they hoping to get out of that? A 240% increase over the next decade in revenues for arms companies in Canada. They're hoping to create 125,000 new jobs and increase military exports by 50%. And again, just like talking about like, okay, who are we, you know, exporting arms to? Like, I think, I think I like hear from like some sort of like more like centrist people, like there's sort of a dream of like, oh, well, like we could like sell like arms to like NATO and like Europe and we could, and they're the good guys. But it's like, no, like the number one place we sell arms to is the U.S. Who's the U.S. In conflict with right now? It's bombing Palestine and bombing Iran, and then who's number two? Saudi Arabia, who's like currently committing horrible acts in Yemen, and is generally not a good player on the world stage that we want to be arming.
Yeah, it's almost sweet how naive people are. And that's the only way I can like not be angry at them. I'm like, oh, you think like this is going to be good? Like you think you're believing Carney when he's like, oh, this is going to boost the economy. Like this is your silver bullet. Like no way.
Yeah.
It's just like, I mean, yeah, we know that, that military production is also like, we just know that that's wrong too. Like not only is that like a cute naive idea that is just completely like not gonna happen, and is kind of immoral generally, but we also know that it's like literally financially wrong. There's been studies that have shown that military production is an inefficient driver of job creation, because it is so much just about investing capital rather than the use of labor. So basically a 2009 study found that for each USD $1 billion is spent on defense, around like 8,500 jobs were created, but the same amount for like more labor intensive industries are much more generative. So that looks like home weatherization and infrastructure, so like housing infrastructure and general building, would create almost 13,000 jobs. Healthcare would also create almost 13,000 jobs. Education would create 17,000 jobs, more than 17,000 jobs. And public transit investments would create almost 20,000 jobs with the exact same amount of that theoretical, $1 billion USD invested into those systems. And so, yeah, we know that in terms of returns on investment, the military and defense generally is not actually good. So if we need to play the economic card, sure, we can, and it's wrong. So like, okay, let's talk about jobs. Let's talk about money. It's not a good return. And so in every aspect, this investment into expansion of defense is evil.
Evil.
Inefficient in terms of financially inefficient, and C, like incredibly short-sighted as well. So it's like, if we're talking about sustainable development, it's not fine. You're gonna make a number of jobs, like 8,000 jobs, fine. But like, what's that going to look like in like 5 years when like, it's just like, it's wrong on every count. It's just wrong.
The other thing that was really interesting, we were reading up on this, is how much of a boom bust economy weapons manufacturing is. And like, it just makes me think about how like, kind of like the core problem of Canada, like since conception, since colonization, has been that we have like staked so much of our industries and economy on extractive industry with incredible boom bust cycles. And, you know, I think about like, a good friend from Alberta whose family worked in oil and gas. And he always says that like, he can like remember like when the price of oil was up and when the price of oil was down by like how many fights were happening in his family. Like, it's just like, it is hard on people to work in, you know, in boom bust economies. It is hard on countries to be reliant on boom bust economies. And so when I think about like, okay, like, you know, pitch without the military, like we're investing billions of dollars to create like new industries in Canada and like maybe get off of this thing where we're like totally reliant on oil and also housing bubble. Okay, awesome. Like, that sounds great. Oh, damn. Picked both an evil one and, you know, one that is once again, you know, boom bust. And so, you know, I just like really dream of for Canada a more stable economy where we're not stuck in these cycles.
Well, and it goes back to these false narratives that Carney and many politicians are talking about, in especially in response to Trump and south of the border, you know, a couple months ago. And this was really, you know, probably the catalyst of why Carney's in power now. But, you know, all the rage before the war ramped up was energy sovereignty. You know, we need energy sovereignty. We need general security measures. That's why so much talk about pipelines was ramping up. We were like, okay, if the U.S. is going to be unreliable, in Canada, we need our own like east-west energy grid, which, I mean, we need our own energy grid for sure. That doesn't even exist yet. But for some reason, instead of talking about building the energy grid, we're talking about building east-west pipelines, and we're talking about offshore drilling, and we're talking about all this expansion into fossil fuel infrastructure that, again, won't last for more than 20 years. And whereas, like, if we really want to talk about energy security and sovereignty, I mean, firstly, let's address the fact that we need to have better nation-to-nation relationships, period. But there are real projects that we could be building in the nation state of Canada, if we're going to be a nation state, that are productive and generative and actually would secure a lot of jobs, firstly, but secondly, an actual public infrastructure and public good. So that looks like an east-west energy grid, that looks like east-west transit and high-speed rail, that looks like large-scale investments into electrifying our future, which would then obviously, you know, start that that journey to come off of fossil fuels. But we're so, we're so entrenched in these boom-bust cycles. Our history, as in Canada's, but also just the West generally, like, you know, for the last 200-300 years, our history is so tied to extraction. And we are so, you know, our governments, our capitalist governments, are so unable to think in a mindset that's not completely tied to extraction and growth. And it's quite thick and twisted that this, like, that the fix for growth is military. Like, what are we doing? It's just like, you kind of are just like, oh my god, like, this is crazy. I feel like I'm constantly just like, all of like, constantly just wanting like to pull back the curtain and be like, the words you're saying don't mean anything.
Yeah.
They mean absolutely nothing. You can say as many pretty words as you want. Like, we're past greenwashing. Greenwashing doesn't even, like, what even, like, that doesn't even matter now. We're so past that. We're on to, like, war, like, I don't even know. It's just, yeah. It's bananas. It feels like
Did you see a small aside? I don't know if folks know, but the one of the main oil and gas lobbying groups for a long time has been called Pathways Alliance. It was sort of like a nod to being like, the energy industry's like pathway to net zero. And like, it was total nonsense and greenwashing the whole time. But they've actually gone through a new rebrand, and it's just, I don't know if I'll get it exactly right, but it's like Canada's Oil and Gas Alliance. Like, it's literally, they're just like, that climate shit, we're done with it.
Yeah. Like, no, we just love oil and gas. Like.
Yeah. But I think like to try to hold on a little bit of hope. I think it is still interesting and inspiring. Like, obviously Seth Klein has written this really good book, A Good War, that I feel really inspired about, talking about how like the World War II war mobilization there, which, you know, I think World War II, a more ethical war if there could be one, but, you know, using that as a blueprint to say like, hey, actually we could do something similar in instead responding to the existential threat of climate change. And like, there are ways that governments can mobilize really quickly, create hundreds of thousands of jobs, build things really quickly. And so it is like the sort of like horrible irony that it's like, okay, we actually are seeing massive industrial policy for the first time in a long time.
True.
In kind of the way that like on the left we've been talking about. Unfortunately, it's like, yeah, in the evil direction. But I think leftists, get into it this year. We are talking about industrial policy. We are talking about job creation. I would say, like, I think I want to like fully pull people out of the sort of like, we're going to live on a commune and my job is going to be upcycling jeans. I would say that I do not want to live in a commune. I love going to raves. I want to live in a city. So I think we need like, we need to be talking about job creation. We need to be talking about like what we want the industries of Canada to be, and being a serious contender at the table.
So true. I feel like this leads really well into our next kind of phase of topic. So, yeah, you're listening to, if you're tuning in now, you're listening to CJLO 1690, our show Towards a Common Horizon, and we'll be back after this ad break.
See you soon.
Hey, what's up? This is Charlie from Black Country New Road, and you are listening to CJLO 1690 AM.
For the best new music from around the globe, with a respectful nod to the musical pioneers of the past and a whole lot more, join me, Danny Payne, on The Pressure Drop every Monday at 5 on CJLO 1690 AM or CJLO.com.
CJLO presents The Big M Show, a series of hour-long theatrical specials featuring all new music from local singer-songwriter extraordinaire Marlena Moore. Over the course of 2026, come out to Theatre VME for dazzling performances, each with their own unique theme, set design, and costumes. They're a fresh take on old-school entertainment and your chance to see your very own Broadway diva at a discount rate. The second Big M Show is coming up on March 29th at 7 p.m. Get your tickets now at mileendimprov.ca.
And we're back. You're listening to Towards a Common Horizon on CJLO 1690. I'm Hope, and I'm joined by Haley.
Hi.
And so far we've been talking about some pretty depressing subjects.
Bleak things,
including the current war. We haven't even actually gotten into the oil crisis, so I think maybe we'll talk about that now. But we kind of started the show with a kind of overview and a bleak disposition, and maybe now is a time to turn towards some of the solutions, and or maybe not even solutions, but ways to think about it that are a little bit more optimistic as well. Before the ad break, Haley was kind of having a bit of a rallying call about, how we can think about large industrial policies. What's happening right now in terms of the investment into defense is pretty horrific. But what if we daydream about what that looks like towards things that we do support and that aren't kind of evil. And yeah, I mean, just going back quickly to before, I forgot to say, you know, investing in oil and gas in Canada is like literally also not profitable when oil reaches over $100 a barrel a day, which it is currently. And so like all Alberta oil people know this, like the crude oil that we produce in Alberta, because of its nature and needing to be shipped down to the States, blah, 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 get refined, whatever. It just means that oil has to be cheap so that we're productive, which is why like no new like oil infrastructure has been passed for a while. But yeah, if anything, now is the worst time to do it too. So if anything, there's a lot of economic arguments. If we want to play the economic card, we can. And the economic arguments are saying that these things are not economically viable. War is not economically viable. Oil and gas are not economically viable. So why are we putting all this money in here? We talked a bit before the outbreak about how, you know, there's all this talk that always happens. I feel like the knee-jerk reaction to so many people talking about any sort of public investments into public infrastructure, into just public good generally, is like, where's the money coming from? Ah! And it's like, from defense. Let's defund all of this defense business and fund the things that we actually need that will create more jobs. We know this. You know, like stimulate the economy, stimulate a more longer vision of a sustainable world, and ideally, you know, lower our carbon emissions eventually so that at least within Canada we can do our part and you know, save our carbon budget. It sounds like so silly at this point because it's like there's so many bigger fish to fry that are immediate, but it's like let's not lose sight of this larger carbon budget that we have, which is, you know, fastly diminishing with every bomb that is being dropped right now.
Yeah, so totally. Also on the funding, you know, like I wouldn't want a big climate investment to come at the cost of like the sort of massive public service layoffs we're seeing. But I think there are like so many places that there is money. And I think one I want to get on my corporate taxes soapbox. So a new report came out from Canadians for Tax Fairness, and it showed that, you know, people like us are, you know, freaking out in the grocery store feeling like things are getting more and more expensive. We're seeing that things are getting more expensive every year. Rent is going up. All these things are going up. Canadian corporations had their most profitable year in history last year in 2025. Like, they just made the most money ever off people like you and me. And that's, you know, obviously, like, that's partially, there's like inflation in there. But there's also, if you look at like the profit rate, so that's like the percentage amount of profits when you look at their books, it's like this year was like the third highest in the last 30 years. And there's this graph from this Canadian for Tax Fairness thing, and it's just like the effective corporate tax rate. You know, corporate taxes are like kind of complicated because there's all these different like things going into it, but they can look at like what the effective average corporate tax rate is, and it's just like a straight hill down, and then the corporate profits straight hill up. So I think there's probably some money to be made there, and I don't have a number pulled up actually, but it was like looking at how much money is being has been lost on these corporate tax cuts, and it's like, I think it's like over $1 trillion in the last 20 years. It's massive. Yeah. And then the other thing is like this final chart that was so interesting was like, you know, these low corporate taxes are being justified by these successful liberal governments as saying like, well, we need to cut corporate taxes so that they will invest and they'll create jobs and they'll invest in industries and whatever. And it's just like, okay, corporate profits spiked in the pandemic and has stayed high. Investment, just a flat line. Like, well, it's just not translating to investment. They're just pocketing it.
They're pocketing it because it's capitalism. Capitalism dictates the fact that what are they going to do? Give us money as the public? That's not their goal. Their goal, like capitalism, which defines how these corporations are run, necessitates them to continue growing. The only reason they would give any sort of public investment back is if they get a tax write-off. Like, that's the only reason that we're getting pennies from these corporations.
Yeah, and it's also the chart was like more looking at like not even like investment in us directly, but like investment in their businesses that would like create more jobs. But like even that is staying flat, and they're just like skimming more off the top. So there is money to do green industrial policy. There is money. We just have to take it. And so that is why Common Horizon's been campaigning hard on an excess profit tax, saying like, okay, these corporations have made massive, gigantic profits over the past while, and it's time to claw some of it back. And that that's like a policy that already has history in Canada. During World War II, they had, I think it was like up to 75% tax on excess profits, because they were like, no, you're not going to make massive profits during a war. And that was actually in contrast with World War I, where there was all this war profiteering. And they, like made these massive profits. And so it was a huge driver of economic inequality. And so we saw, during World War II, this tax, and it meant that, that those excess profits were reinvested in the government. And so we can do the same thing. There also was, under Trudeau, a small excess profit tax put into place on the banking and insurance industry. It was just for like a couple of years. But this is like a tax that has been used recently, and so I think it's totally something that could be used to fund the kind of policy we're talking about.
So what policies are these? I think so. Obviously, we're seeing a lot of headlines these days about the current energy crisis that we're facing. Average people are seeing it at the pumps, but also we're going to see it real soon in terms of prices of groceries. Fossil fuels dominate entire global economies, and so everything is just going to get more expensive. I think people are already starting to see it in their mortgage rates. It's about to have some pretty lasting cascading effects, which made me look into the last large kind of energy crisis from the 70s. Which has been quite inspiring and interesting. So, even before we go there, currently, with lower energy or oil reserves, a lot of countries are already just implementing like fail-safe solutions. These are a lot of like global South countries who have fewer oil reserves, who are literally making sure that they can last for an indefinite amount of period of time. And these are places that maybe only have like 20 days of oil reserves versus, other countries that have might be more like 200 days. But Sri Lanka, for example, has declared every Wednesday a holiday for public officials. Myanmar is limiting the use of private vehicles, allowing drivers to use them every other day to save gas. Bangladeshi colleges have canceled classes. South Korea has lifted limits on burning coal. Local governments in the Philippines have shifted to 4-day work weeks. Even in like Thailand, they've changed, or they're encouraging working from home, and they're even encouraging people who are like in public official roles that they are allowed to wear like short sleeves instead of suits and ties, because AC is becoming more and more expensive to use. And so there's all these shrinking like policies in effect to that are reacting to the fact that oil is scarce. And so looking back at the 70s, when oil was also really scarce then, we know that a lot of policies were put in place to encourage households to limit their energy consumption. But not only was it done on the individual level, but a lot of countries thought about this in the future. They were like, okay, well, we're in an energy crisis, and should this happen again, we should be a little bit more resilient in terms of not being as dependent upon oil. And so countries like Denmark, who burned oil for almost everything, heating, transport, electricity, they really invested in their modern wind power. And invested huge amounts in investing in wind. And now their country's energy profile is 91% wind. So, they're actually very little affected relatively in the global scale to this energy crisis that they're facing right now, because they're on wind, which is not defined by oil. And then also, like, the Dutch, for example, they banned cars on Sunday. And I think, you know, we think about Amsterdam, we think about all these bikers everywhere and, like, all these cyclist infrastructure, and it's amazing. And it's like, that didn't just, like, happen passively. That happened because the country was like, oh, you know, energy crises means, you know, that gas is less available and we should ban cars on Sundays. But not only should we ban cars on Sundays, but we should actually invest in infrastructure that limits our dependency on cars generally and doesn't actually rely on fossil fuels at all, such as cycling. And so they redid a lot of their cities to be cycle cities. And now, you know, they don't have to worry as much about fossil fuel spikes because in prices, because people are just using their own bodies to move around. And I think the most interesting one for me was Northern Europe in terms of the cold countries. And so Canada is often one of the highest per capita usages of fossil fuels. And a lot of people will tell you, oh, it's because Canada is a cold country. We have a lot of heating and cooling that we need to do more than other countries in the world. Okay, but what about Scandinavia? They're also actually quite northern climates. You would think that they would also per capita use a lot of energy. But no, because after the oil crisis in the 70s, they invested a huge amount of money into efficient ways of keeping warm, and so into insulating their homes and into replacing oil-fired boilers in people's homes with centralized district heating systems, which are A, more efficient, and B, can then also be connected to electric grids. And so, you know, mass investments went into making these systems more efficient, electrified, but also, which ultimately had the effect of lowering overall energy usages. And so, like, I think in Canada, 30% of our fossil fuel or of our carbon emissions come from buildings alone because they are poorly insulated. And so we're putting all this money and energy into heating our homes when, you know, most of that is being released in, like, faulty windows, in, like, you know, poor insulated basements and roofs and walls, like, really boring, like, tedious things, but that make a huge amount of difference, not only in terms of the actual energy that we're spending, but obviously this is reflected in people's energy bills all the time. You know, we talk about home heating and energy poverty all the time. Like, these things can be dual solutions to both energy crises and affordability. Like, this is what Common Horizon is all about. This is about matching and mirroring solutions for the climate crisis with affordability crises that we're also facing. So it's like, this is an opportunity truly to transform our economy towards something that is truly investing in its populations in terms of, you know, making things more affordable, because literally because we're lowering our dependency on fossil fuels, which are so volatile, which are so connected to war, which are so connected to extractivism and these systems of capital that are just no longer tenable.
Yeah. And it's actually, like, awesome the way that Canada is actually in an incredibly good position for a transition renewable energies. The things that you need, like, there's so much, like, fear-mongering stuff of being like, oh, well, the wind doesn't always blow. And, like, you know, like, that is true. But God bless my dad, he really, like, went on a journey. And one day maybe I'll have him call in and talk through his spreadsheet. And for a while it was like, I would call home and my mom would be like, you got to talk to your dad about the spreadsheet. Like, he's a little anxious about it, but he really wants to talk to you about it. And basically he was like, really curious. He was like, okay, is this true? Like, can we match the peaks and troughs of, you know, the variable weather? And basically what he found is, like, Canada's actually in an incredibly good position because you just need to have a grid that is bigger than a weather system. And so if we can get all of Canada connected up and producing renewable energy across the country, like, the amount of backup battery storage that we need is actually quite low. And it's also, like, you know, he was also concerned about, like, okay, but, like, what about the land usage? Like, would you just have to, like, blanket every square inch in, you know, solar panels and stuff? And no, it's, like, actually, like, a really reasonable amount. And so we're, like, the good news is, like, we're actually, like, in a potentially incredible position, and countries that are like much smaller, have much higher population, less land, are in a much more difficult position. Like Canada is well positioned for this economy to not only provide our own energy needs, but like become a global superpower. And like there is like a similar calculation my dad did, was like, you know, could you replace all of the economic drivers from the oil sands with renewables? And it's totally possible. We got to get him on.
Yeah.
I don't know. He's shy. Aww. But yeah, it was like, it was really good news. Like we are in a good position. We just need to do this, like, yeah, massive industrial policy investment to get it going and stop like putting our finger being like, no, actually we're going to keep subsidizing pipelines that don't make any money if we don't subsidize.
Yeah. I mean, it's always one of those things where we have the solutions. We've known the solutions for a long time. We have really great ones, actually. We don't even need to reinvent the wheel. We don't need to rely on technology at all. We don't need to put our faith in, you know, this like deus ex machina that's going to come and save us. We already can save us. We have everything. It's just about the political will to be able to do this. And, you know, people are getting duped thinking that these aren't possible. They don't know that things are possible. And they also just don't believe that they can be, because they've been sold these lies to think that this is the only way to live. Yeah. And that there's no money for this. And like, as we've talked about in this episode, or this hour so far, there's money in both the amount of cutting that's being done and being redirected to defense. So that's a ton of money there. And then there's money that is being hoarded by these big corporations and billionaires that we can also take. So there's two actually very lucrative pots of revenue that we can be taking from to fund things like an east-west energy grid and insulating our homes better. And these would lower costs for everybody. It would create so many jobs. I'm like imagining the jobs of that would be created by creating an east-west energy grid and high-speed rail across the country. Like that's so many jobs right there. Like if we can't even see that, like what, like that's what we should be spending our money. Like it's just it feels like a no-brainer, you know. And obviously these are my beliefs and this is what I believe we should be going towards, but I do think, like, you know, there's science behind this. There's a lot of good data that backs these solutions up, and it's just about the political will, which is, you know, why we're yapping today, why we do this work at Common Horizon is, you know, our job is to try to shift that political will and shift that imagination, that public imagination, towards believing that these things are possible. And not only are they possible, but they're something that we should all be fighting for.
Totally. Yeah. And I think one of the biggest things that we can do is just like talking to people, having conversations. And that's why like a lot of what we do at Common Horizon is canvassing and having conversations with people at their farmer's market, on their doorstep, etc. I think also if you're like, you know, well, one, come with us, come take that plunge. But if you're not ready for that plunge, I think also just like talking to the people around you. I think like people's opinions are, you know, changeable. And actually, like a lot of the time people are just like, maybe it's just like truly vibe based what they're working with. And if you're like bringing some different perspectives, you know, you can really shift someone's opinion. Like I was actually, yeah, talking with my dad about, yeah, this like industrial policy thing. And he was really like under the impression that we were like selling mostly to the EU and stuff like that. And was like really shocked how much that we're like finding or we're selling to the US and to Saudi Arabia. Mm. And he was like, oh, that's like actually such a game changer in my opinion on this. Yeah, and then also like pre-quote the spreadsheet was like kind of like a green energy transition skeptic. Mm. And like he really like went on his journey, but it was also like me talking to him about it. And now like he's like he is at dad's night, he is at the bar, he is talking to his boys.
Like, did you know?
Yeah, no, he's like it really, he's like, I'm spreading the good news. So yeah, he's like, you gotta talk to people about it, and like, you know, not just like your leftist friends, but your parents, the people in your lives.
Yeah. And the good thing is the polling is showing that most people don't really approve of this war anyway, so I think an easy way to in is just saying like, yeah, that's crazy. And also people are obviously not happy with gas prices going up. It's very simple. Like, oh, you know, we don't like war because, yeah, most people are like, we don't really want war to happen. But not only do we not want war, but selfishly, I don't want my gas to go up. So
yeah,
anything that stops that, oh, cool. I can be richer in life spiritually and financially and also believe in the future. Maybe I should do that.
Totally. You know? Yeah. I think like finally, like just the insanity of this is, they knew. It was like the Strait of Hormuz, everyone knows, like, that's why you don't bomb Iran, because they will block the Strait of Hormuz. Like, it's like a completely predictable crisis. But anyways, that's been Hope and I on our soapbox today. But I think the final sentiment I think we can leave with you with is like, while it is currently being mobilized for evil, governments have a huge amount of power to act quickly, change industry, and mobilize money. And it's up to us to decide what direction that goes in. And I think there is a lot of energy right now to be like, we need industrial policy. We need job creation. Like, there's like the record of youth unemployment. Like, now is the time to be acting. And I think it's like up to organizing to be like, and actually in this direction, dear God. So, yeah.
Amazing way to finish. Well, yeah, thank you for listening. We're here every 2 weeks on Sundays at 8 p.m. You're listening to